Viktor Frankl said, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson. Stay tuned for the next hour as Sue explores the human psyche, what makes us tick, and how to live better, more fulfilled, and more meaningful lives. Only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. And my guest today is Dr. Tracy Farber in Israel. And our topic is building resilience and finding hope. I would like to, first of all, dedicate today's program to Neil Salipsky, who passed away recently in Cape Town. Neil was a longtime friend of my brother-in-law, Stephen Hubert, in London. They met on a kibbutz in Israel in 1968. And I had the privilege of talking to Neil when Steve was in South Africa in February this year. And Neil very graciously wanted to tell me how much he enjoyed my program and Chai FM. And we didn't actually realize he was quite so ill. And he was just so gracious. So I extend, and Steve extends, his sincere condolences to the Salipsky family. Right, let me introduce Tracy. Hi, Tracy. First of all, thank you to Les Glassman, who introduced Tracy and I. And many of you I know Tracy personally and professionally. Her CV is pages long. She is a clinical psychologist and psychodynamic. She's specializing in trauma, a trauma specialist, a trainer, a supervisor, and she does a lot of PTSD trauma. She is on Zoom, and she has her own private practice in Tel Aviv. She made Aliyah in 2019. To Israel, but many of you are still in contact with her, and I've had a lot of messages since the Facebook went out. Her doctoral research was formed on the basis of it was the basis is what formed the basis of her book, Catastrophic Grief, Trauma, and Resilience from Camp Survivors. And this was what her PhD research results. I'm really suffering today. Her PhD was actually based on a lot of her research results. Welcome, Tracy. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, Sue. Thank you very much for inviting me to be on your show.
Thanks so much for coming on. And you sent me this wonderful quote by Golda Meir today. Pessimism is a luxury that a Jew can never allow himself. And that is something that you know about and I know about, and we know about hope and clinging on to hope. Tell me, Tracy, a little bit about your life in Israel since getting there. You arrived there in 2019. I heard your Telfed talk, and you said that you arrived in the middle of COVID. How Yes. did you cope personally with that?
There was an opportunity to do an internship in Israel. I've been wanting to move for a long time. And when I was told the internship was available, then actually once COVID started, I thought my plans to make Aliyah would not happen. But then once that happened, I wasn't sure. I thought I would maybe be here for a year or so, but I didn't realize I would want to stay.
Wow. And being there in COVID, where did you get your support from? Oh, okay. This is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. And my guest today is Dr. Tracy Farber. And we're getting back to that now.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. And my guest today is Dr. Tracy Farber. And Tracy is now living in Israel. She made Aliyah in 2019, as I said. And she has also started, before we go into your experiences in Israel, I would like to discuss with you the International Jewish Association of Trauma Therapists, which was established in January this year after the anti-Semitic terrorist attack at Bondi Beach in Australia. Tracy, you are a founder of this. Why did you feel that it was necessary to form an International Jewish Association of Trauma Therapists?
Sue, if I can say it, the thought came to me that we don't have anything international for Jewish trauma therapists. They're therapists, of course, trauma therapists in Israel, in South Africa, and in the US. But I was thinking after Bondi that there had been a few terrorist attacks or anti-Semitic attacks in America, in Manchester. Of course, we were just coming out of 7th of October. And then after Bondi, I suggested to my colleague, Dr. Martin Strauss from SAGMAP, which is the South African Association of Allied, Jewish Association of Allied and Medical, Allied Medical Professionals. So we were talking and I said, you know, we need something for an international group to cope with terrorist attacks and anti-Semitism. And so I reached out to the leader of the therapists in Australia, and she said that they need support. I asked her. And the thing is, we as psychologists are not licensed to work in other countries. And so I thought the best way of actually creating a network is to support the therapists. And so what I organized was, firstly, I got a committee together. So Dr. Strauss is on my committee. We've got another two people from Australia. We've got two from the US. And we've got Professor Meirav Roth from Israel, with also someone named Tanya, who is the head of Get Help Israel. So I got this committee together to support what we were doing. And so what we've done is we have presented lectures to therapists. I asked for some senior therapists to help me. And instead of expected to get about 10, Martin sent out a WhatsApp, and suddenly I had 113 senior clinicians worldwide who were offering to help. So that was really an unbelievable day.
What a response.
It was unbelievable. My phone was going off. I felt sad at the end of that day because I thought, my God, this was such a unique experience. I thought it's probably unlikely this will ever happen in my life again. But it was such a feeling of what it means to be Jewish. Uh-huh. That it kind of flew all around. And, you know, at first we had 36, then we had 50, then 80. And so now we have this group.
I see you've got 96 at the moment, senior trauma therapists from United States, Israel, South Africa, Australia.
We have 113 senior consultants.
Wow.
And then we have 190 therapists. So then we've at the moment got over 300 people. And what we did in Australia is I spoke about a trauma therapy and updated their knowledge because a lot of them hadn't had experience in working with trauma in Australia because they've led a very kind of untraumatized experience, so to speak. And we've had a series of lectures. Professor Roth has spoken on trauma twice. We've had someone from the Tel Aviv University speaking about vicarious traumatization. And so we've had about twice a month. And that's the idea, that all the therapists can pool knowledge and sort of gain expertise. And then what we've also done is we've provided supportive consultation for therapists in Australia. So far, we have created six supervision groups of therapists, and we've also allocated some individuals so that they have at least two free sessions to sit within a group or with other therapists to talk about what their experiences have been like working with trauma. because we know that therapists get very, very emotionally drained from listening to trauma, and they really also need to be heard. So now we have been busy with Australia for 3 months, and we're now going to be pivoting to work with therapists in Israel, because as you know, we've just come through 5 weeks of a very difficult war.
Absolutely. And you know, what I find very fascinating is that you say that in Australia, they've led relatively traumatic-free lives compared to us here in South Africa, where many of us have been hijacked, held at gunpoint. I'm surprised because they have got the most Holocaust survivors in Australia compared to most other countries in the world. So you would think that they were more au fait, really, with trauma. But it's perhaps this is the second generation, and in many cases the third generation, who is now finding that this is what they're working through. I have had people on about Bondi, Jewish people from Australia, on my program, terribly, terribly shocked, obviously, by it. The trauma is definitely just affecting everybody. So are you finding that a lot of the time when you get calls, just meanwhile anonymous calls sometimes, are a second generational trauma?
So
in London as well.
It's been mentioned because apparently Melbourne has the hugest, outside of Israel, Australia outside of Israel, has got the highest amount of second generation Holocaust survivors. And we've looked, we focused more on Bondi, but there've been a lot of people who've been in Bondi, as we know, who are the children or the great-grandchildren of survivors. So while a lot of the people were carrying second-generational trauma, their life in Bondi up until now has not been a traumatized life. We know because a lot of our South Africans have immigrated there, and they didn't have a reason to have expertise in trauma, because the therapists there were maybe dealing with depression, were dealing with normal kind of problems that therapists might address. And so now the trauma, of course, will open up second generational trauma.
And we're going to get back to that.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. If you would like to contact us, please do so on our WhatsApp, 061-895-1019. If you have any questions for Tracy, please just dial that number and send a message through. This is 101.9 High FM. If you want to tell other people to be listening in, Dr. Tracy Farber is my guest today. She's a clinical psychologist, an author, and a supervisor, and she runs resilience workshops in schools and mental health clinics. And she also built a five-step model of resilience, and this she runs for teachers and parents. And I should imagine that this is, Tracy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay. I should imagine that five-step model of resilience is very popular at the moment in Israel at schools, and actually just because a lot of people I know personally that a lot of people have never, we might have, especially ex-South Africans, might have experienced the trauma here, but thought it was a safe haven, and then suddenly, as you said in your Telfed talk, they were running into bomb shelters. How do you deal with children then? How do you deal with yourself? How would your five-step program model of resilience work with this?
So just to say, Sue, that again, and I wanted to refer about that quote that I said about Golda Meir and the pessimism. I mean, I think that's a very unique Jewish perspective, that one has to just keep going in the face of trauma. Because, you know, she was talking about how this country's been battered and how people have to keep getting up after every war and keep going and keep going. And before I talk about resilience, I just want to say that it's become a kind of an overused word, and it can also be understood as a pressure for people who are not coping to feel like they must be resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we can talk about resilience until we acknowledge that people have had terrible experiences of loss, of tragedy, that the 7th of October was the worst tragedy that we've seen since the Holocaust, that people, as we know, I mean, were deeply dehumanized, and we now have hostages who are recovering, and again, a whole lot of soldiers who are dying. And so it is, we're working with an ongoing tragedy. And there are people who have different perspectives on resilience. And I think from what I understand resilience to be is, if we look at Holocaust survivors and we say, what can we learn from them? In many ways, it was the capacity to continue building and living their lives. And they compartmentalized their grief and their mourning and their PTSD symptoms. The resilient ones were able to walk forward, and at the same time, that many of them inside suffered with symptoms and bad dreams all their lives, but they had the capacity to move forward. They had the capacity to find hope, to continue building despite their pain. And so for me, my understanding of resilience from what I studied about them and what I reviewed in the literature about other resilient survivors is that they have the capacity to move forward with both, with a deep sense of grief and trauma, and at the same time focusing on what's still good, on what they can still look forward to, where they can find hope, where they can build. And so in Hebrew, we say gam v'gam, which means also and also, which means the terrible pain and also the capacity to see where one can find love, contribute, and see the good and find hope.
And, you know, on that note, I was reading something that Elie Wiesel said, and he said that he was talking, it was quite a long, it was on hope, despair, and memory. And he said he believes that without memory, our existence would be barren and opaque, like a prison cell into which no light penetrates, like a tomb which rejects the living. And he said that memory, for him, hope without memory is like memory without hope.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, I just find that as far, he said, man cannot live without dreams. He cannot live without hope. Our dreams reflect the past. Our hope summons the future. And I think that is so important, because so many people at the moment are being triggered. And as you say, they are having to tap into deeper parts of themselves in order to help themselves and also to help their families cope with what's happening.
Absolutely. And I think that your quote about Elie Wiesel is incredibly relevant to what I'm saying and connects to what I'm saying, because he's saying don't go into blind hope, which is like denial.
Mm.
Don't go in, and an example with that would be blind positivity. You can't talk to someone who's been through a terrible grief and talk to them about being positive. It's not possible for them. But what they can do is, you know, in some way hold the pain and look to see what they can still be thankful for, focus on the people that love them, try and see the good. And for people who've been through deep grief and tragedy, sometimes they can't do this for a period of time, sometimes even a very long period of time. It's an ongoing journey. But what Wiesel is saying, I think, is you have to hold the memory of the unbearable trauma of the Holocaust in order to also find hope. And he's saying it's hard to hold both together, but hope without an acknowledgement of the trauma is not seeing the whole picture. Mm-hmm. So in some way, for me, that quote of what you're saying is also about gum for gum, the mm-hmm. terrible memory and also the hope for the future.
Absolutely. And, you know, in your book, the catastrophic grief, trauma, and resilience in child concentration camp survivors. You mention that the Shoah, the genocide, that the Holocaust, the Shoah, means catastrophe. Now, that's something I didn't know. Is it a Greek word?
So I was looking for a word to describe catastrophic grief, to describe terrible grief. Because these people had lost, these children that I interviewed people in their old age, but they had been children during the Holocaust. And their grief was terrible because they'd lost their mother, their father, sometimes one or both parents, siblings, homes, their communities. A lot of them then left after the Holocaust, and I was looking for a way of explaining terrible grief. And I used the word catastrophic to describe it, because if you translate Shoah into English, it means catastrophe. It doesn't necessarily mean the Holocaust. It means any catastrophe. So a lot of people after 7th of October would be saying Shoah, Zeaya Shoah, which means it was a catastrophe. It was a catastrophe. So I'm talking about catastrophic grief, as in grief in a situation of catastrophe.
And, you know, I think that's very relevant, quite honestly. Just going back to what's happening around the world at the moment, the anti-Semitism, what happened in London last week, the attacks on innocent Jews just walking the streets. Are you finding that a lot more people are wanting to therapy or wanting to talk about it? Do you think, what would you advise? Would you advise group therapy for something like that, or personal? Or would you have to assess it yourself?
Well, what I want to talk about, and I'm going to leave the name with you, Sue. In America, there's a volunteer organization that has been set up, and the psychologists run groups for victims of anti-Semitism. So I will leave the number with you.
Okay, we'll put it on the IFM website.
Yes, I will leave you the absolute number. And what they do, and the only thing is, people might need to wake up during the middle of the night. It was started by Tara Lieberman, who is also we're lucky enough to have her on our RJAT committee. So she is a member of my committee, and she has started up this whole organization. So anybody can, it's called the Jewish Community Mental Health Initiative. And so they do run groups. And they run them globally, and they're free support groups. And so anybody can join. So I will give you the number.
Okay.
And people can contact for the group. And if anybody listening feels that they want to be part of a group, I think it's also a very good way of connecting Jews worldwide. And she has two psychologists who facilitate the group, and you know, South Africans are absolutely welcome to join. She has Israelis, people in America, because I think worldwide people are now, we're finding ourselves in a new world where people are having to deal with anti-Semitism in a way that we were not used to, you know, even 5 or 10 years ago.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's a very good number to have. We'll put it on the Chai FM website. Please, won't you, if you want to ask Tracy anything, please do so on 061-895-1019. Tracy, in your talk, your Telfed talk that I was listening to, if anyone wants to listen or see Tracy in person, go on to YouTube and just type in.
It's actually not on YouTube at the moment.
It's not. Okay, that's
not. It's not on YouTube. If I can explain what I did,
yeah.
I did a Telfed I spoke about the relevance of trauma. What can we learn from the Holocaust?
And you also spoke about the normal reactions to abnormal events. Sure. So can we tie that in with Israel at the moment?
Sure. If I can just say, Sue, what I did do at Telfed and what I did at the Tel Aviv University as well, is I spoke about what can we learn from the Holocaust to help us understand trauma in the present context. So it actually, the video isn't on YouTube, but it was what I spoke about.
It was the alumni. Yeah, okay. It wasn't that I saw then. It was the Tel Aviv University that's on.
Oh, okay.
Processing. Anyway, that's when I was listening.
Okay.
So you spoke about the social support, that how we need social support. Should we start with that?
Wherever you want to start.
I would like to ask you, you know, especially with so many of people making Aliyah at the moment from around the globe, they are leaving family behind here or behind in London or America, wherever they're leaving, and making Aliyah to Israel. Is social support only found within families?
No, I think definitely not. I think social support is found very much in community centers for people who are from definitely the synagogue or the shul, and the community kind of forming around that is a very, very strong community support. And then, of course, if you have children at a school, then the school will be community support. So I think support is very important. And what one sees in Israel is that communities do rally around and support. There's a lot of volunteer work that goes on here with animals, with people, with soldiers, with packing food, with cooking, with all kinds of things when wars start. And so here there's a lot of practical support as well. And we know that that support is critical in building resilience. We know that when children come from homes where they feel loved, that builds coping skills, that builds resilience. And so there's, of course, families are not perfect. Parents are not perfect. We're looking at good enough parents, build resilient children. And so, of course, it starts off in the home. But I think that even in schools, in all communities need to see how they're supporting people, because children who feel supported are able to access hope, and they're able to also access a sense of agency in times of trauma. They're able to navigate trauma better. It doesn't mean it doesn't affect them, but we know that hope we find in the arms of our parents. It happens when a child feels trust and they don't feel comfortable and the parent keeps responding to their needs. That builds a sense of hope. And we build hope in terms of our attachment to family and our attachment to friends. And then, of course, in the wider community. But it is absolutely critical that communities under stress see how they can build ongoing support for people.
And I think that is not only important for Israel, it's certainly very important for South Africa at the moment, when many families have children and grandchildren living in Israel. And just on that point, you know, apparently a pediatrician here, a well-known pediatrician, said that he's been seeing a lot of young children coming from Israel to visit their grandparents. Suddenly the skies are open again and flights could start. And he's seeing a lot of children, parents bringing the children in because of excessive OCD symptoms, anxiety, tearfulness, unable to sleep. And he's seeing that a lot. So when the children are listening, hearing sirens and bombs, and it must be a terrible shock to them, especially when they've led a relatively free life, you know, walking to school at a certain age. They're allowed to jump onto buses.
So I think to look at this in a in a kind of a to zoom out and to look at it in the best, in the objective, in the most objective way possible. I think children in this country are really brought up with a sense of belonging. They know they belong here. They are treasured by society in many, many ways. And yes, of course, on the outside, it was very difficult to know that there were mothers running to shelters carrying their babies in the middle of the night. And one can't underestimate the anxiety from the constant sirens, etc., etc. But again, I want to emphasize that one can't only look at the trauma, and that mothers who, and fathers, I want to emphasize fathers here too, that fathers who are able to hold and soothe their babies, and mothers who are able to sit and explain and hug and soothe, that if for those children, those parents are the most important. And of course, sometimes the parents are undone and don't really cope very well. We have to worry more or the most about children where there are very, very big problems in the family, to children who are unbonded to their parents, where there's domestic violence at home, and there are those pre-occurring problems. And then we have sirens and all kinds of kind of environmental difficulties. Families here do have, you know, the people here do have coping skills, and I don't want to give the impression that all children are suffering from anxiety and OCD. Of course, there are those that are, and I don't particularly specifically work with children, but I work with parents, and there are many children who are coping.
Well, that's really good to hear. Thank you, Craig.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and you're about to listen to an audio clip of Edith Eger, who passed away recently. And many of you know Edith Eger, a Holocaust survivor, psychiatrist, really a wonderful, wonderful person. Thank you, Craig.
Part of me was left in Auschwitz, but not the better part, not the bigger part.
Do you forgive the people that did so many terrible things to you?
I forgive myself and not allowing them to take residence in my body anymore. I release them. It's not me forgiving them for what they did to me. I think it's mostly liberating myself, partially that I survived, and for me to invest my energy to the future. I find a tremendous satisfaction knowing that now I'm a mother of three and a grandmother of four, and that my children and grandchildren look at their grandma, and when I go to the schools and the children say, when I grow up, I want to be like you, to be a good role model, for the children to know that they too have choices about sex, about drugs. To be a survivor is to be flexible, to bend, and not to be rigid. So to me, hatred breeds hatred, and I have no time to hate. I don't forget what happened to me. I may not even overcome that. I think I came to terms with it, and I was able to integrate. Took me 40 years, and I'm still not done. And I don't live in Auschwitz. Part of me was left in Auschwitz, but not the better part, not the bigger part. I think I'm capable of having joy and passion and live a full life. I gave the Nazis my health, my talent as a ballerina. They could not rob me, but I couldn't dance after I came back. My parents, my grandparents, so why would I give them another inch? And so to me, this is the way I commit myself to life and to healing, by opening up communications between parents and children. And as a psychologist and a family and a sex therapist, I feel very good that I am able to carry the word that my parents didn't die in vain. And I'm also able to be named as the woman of the year who commits herself to the bettered wives. and using the experience to see that there were choices even in Auschwitz.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. And that was Dr. Edith Eger, who passed away recently. And she was talking about her experiences in the concentration camps. She was a young girl, had to dance for Mengele in order to stay alive. And Tracy, are you there?
I'm right, yes, Sue.
And what did you think about what she said?
I think it's deeply moving. Every time I hear her, every time I read her, and I think what's particularly relevant for me and from where I'm coming from my research and my background, she speaks about the choices that we all make and the choices to hold on to goodness in the face of terrible pain, you know, she says that there was always a choice in Auschwitz. And I think that that's applicable to all of us, because when we go through difficult experiences, it's kind of like it can bring out frustration, anger, lots of difficulties and rage. And she carried rage and survivor guilt for so many years. But she chose to lead a life where she offered the best of herself. And we know that she was plagued with survivor guilt for many, many decades over the death of her mother. And she said she lived with this and she was still trying to integrate all her trauma, which I think was very honest of about, you know, a very honest kind of account of what she was still going through, because some people came out of the Holocaust, I think many, many, and the pain was so bad that they couldn't even begin to integrate. But she was very honest about her emotional struggles. And I think her honesty shed light and opened up so much hidden stuff for everybody, because that survivor guilt, and we know a lot of people are sitting with survivor guilt here as well, is a very, very difficult psychological difficulty to live with.
Absolutely. And you know what? I often think that it's that survivor guilt that can stop the joy. And I was listening, the joy in life.
Definitely.
Embracing what life is. And I was listening to a YouTuber, a 96-year-old Holocaust survivor. I can't remember her name offhand. But she was 15 in Auschwitz. And she remembers her mom just turning around once. She didn't realize she would never see her again, and looking at her and smiling. That was the last memory of her mother. And she said for so many years, like Edith, she had this guilt. And then she thought, no, her weapon of choice and how she was going to run her life and her children, for her children, the best mother she could be, was to embrace joy. The joy of being alive and being able to bring another generation of Jews into the world.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a battle that people sit with when there is survivor guilt. And I think that, you know, when you say that it does spoil the joy, that is exactly what survivor guilt does. You know, we have on the one side the part of us that knows how to feel joy and love and passion, and on the other side, the survivor guilt that tells people that that must feel so terrible because of what happened. Sometimes the survivor guilt's not even rational. And so it's like the life instinct and the death instinct, and that survivor guilt can strangle a person's capacity for joy. So I think for people who go through these very difficult experiences, having to wrestle with their survivor guilt and being able to climb out of the darkness and claim freedom and joy, it's a very, very difficult journey that they go through.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about Rachel Goldberg-Pollan at the moment, when she lost her son Hirsch hostage. He was held hostage and then murdered in Gaza. And she has taken on, she's written a book, and now she's on a speaking tour, I think. But, you know, she took on the responsibility of keeping his memory alive. And I think for many people, it is to take on something greater than yourself, whether it's your children, as this 96-year-old woman did, or just a project that's greater than you are, that you can put your energy into. It's part of the healing. Do you agree?
I do think that it's part of the healing, but I wouldn't sit and tell people that in therapy, because it's not prescriptive. You know, people can only find their meaning when they've processed their suffering. And one can't rush that.
We can't give them meaning.
No, we can't give anyone meaning. And we definitely can't tell somebody to find meaning when they're in terrible pain. And I can't emphasize enough that when a parent loses a child, it is the ultimate worst pain that we know. I don't think it's a pain any of us can understand unless we've been there ourselves. Having worked with a fair, I'll continue after the break.
Okay.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. My guest today is Dr. Tracy Farber. She's in Israel. And we are talking about how we can deal with the anti-Semitism in the world at the moment, with trauma. She'd started this. She's a founder of the group IJATT, the International Jewish Association of Trauma Therapists, and which is quite amazing. It's got people from all around the world that she's got working through this. There are a few questions, Tracy, that did come through to me.
Sorry to interrupt you, Sue. Mm. Can I just finish before you go on to your question about what I was saying? No problem. I wanted to say about Hirsch's mother.
Yes.
That I think that level of pain, to go through that pain, is the worst kind of pain that people can imagine. And having worked with some mothers who've lost children, they often go through periods where they feel that it's very hard for them to find a reason to live, because no parent should have to live with that kind of pain. And so, I mean, she is so brave in doing what she's doing, because she speaks about what a struggle it is to live with that level of grief. And what I wanted to say about the meaning and the finding meaning, we can't tell people to find meaning. It's something that can happen, that happens to people. And for some Holocaust survivors, they never found meaning. I had some in my study who said to me, there is no meaning. They've lived lives. They were appreciative of their wives or their husbands and their children. But they said what they lost in the Shoah had no meaning. And so I think the best thing that we can do for people who've suffered terrible losses, whether it's Holocaust survivors or people we know from now, is to actually bear witness, to sit with them and to be a presence that acknowledges their terrible pain and loss. And as human beings, obviously we do that in a very specific way in therapy, but you don't need to be a therapist to do it. I think that as for mothers to witness their children, for fathers to acknowledge and show empathy and sit with people who are suffering, because we know that people who are suffering experience what is called existential aloneness. They feel completely alone and that nobody understands. So we don't have to understand somebody's suffering, but to just sit with somebody and be a presence so that person doesn't feel so alone. That is doing a lot. And whether one does that in a shiva house by listening to people's pain, or whether one does it in any kind of context, that human empathy and caring is the most important thing that we have to offer traumatized people. And that builds resilience.
Absolutely. And I think we must never underestimate a person's resilience, quite honestly, because I have seen people at the end of their lives who've who their family have said, oh, they'll never cope with this. And so they were telling the family that the person who was ill that they weren't that ill. And meanwhile, the person who was so ill was trying to protect the family. But so there was this pretense, that elephant in the room. And there was huge, such a sense of loss by the family, by the patient that I was seeing, that it was really terrible. And until gradually they began to talk to each other in obviously in sessions, and that elephant started disappearing, and understanding was coming in. And when each person realized that they had been trying to protect one another, it was suddenly the gates opened.
Yes.
And the light came in.
Yes. And this is something
I mentioned gates. Now you talk about gates as well. Tell
yes,
me about.
I wanted to talk about protection, this issue of protection. Mm. And it always fascinated me that often when I worked with children who'd been traumatized, even young children, they would tell me they would fear they were what they'd been through, whether it was a hijack or whatever it was, and I would say to them, have you told your mom or your dad how awful you're feeling? And most often they would say to me, no, I haven't, because mommy's really upset and I don't want to make her feel worse. Mm-hmm. Or daddy's very cross about the robbers and I don't want him to get cross. So it is so important in the case of trauma that those gates at some stage do get crossed, that they are broken, and that people, children are encouraged by parents to talk about what they've experienced so that they don't feel so alone. And so this gives parents access to understanding, because unless the gates come down, even in families, people remain quite alone with their experience.
And I must admit, I saw that so often when I was working at children's hospital. And, you know, as you say, the children not sharing with their parents so often, it was actually very interesting to see the various children who were protecting their parents or their siblings, quite honestly. So what you say is so true. Those gates have to come down. And when I was working at Children's Hospital, it was a long time ago, parents were only allowed to visit children once a day, unlike today. Now, there was one other thing that came across, which I think was very important, Tracy, and it says, this was from a non-Jew, and they asked how best they could support Jewish friends. But I'm being told to wrap up, so we are going to have to meet again, Tracy. Would you agree to that?
Sure.
Are you there, Tracy?
Yes, that's fine. We can, for sure.
Okay. I would like you now just to give out your contact details for people.
I'll leave them with you.
Okay, you'll leave them with me and we'll put them on there, especially if you're interested in the International Jewish Association of Trauma Therapy. Thank you so much, Tracy, for being on my program today. A lot of questions did come through, which we will do next time. I'm being told to wrap up. Time for the news. Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Vusi. And thank you so much, Tracy.